Right, let's get
Yeah.
going. Good morning. Welcome everybody to our latest Employment Law 101 webinar. Great that you're joining us live today. Because you get a chance to pick our brains and ask questions as we go along. For those of you that don't know us, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with a specialist employment law and business immigration practice called MPM Legal. We're based in the south of England, but we help employers that are all over the world. They have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK, and that's how we help. Delighted as ever to be joined by my colleague Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Good morning. Good morning.
And yeah, as I said, we're both in the office today. Normally one of us is remote working, or both of us are remote working, but we're both here in sunny Henley-on-Thames today. So that's good, isn't it?
Sunny. Look out the window. It's not sunny.
I'm just pretending that
It's
it's sunny.
grey.
Wishful thinking. Great to have so many of
Yeah.
you on the call today. Just a couple of housekeeping points. If you want to ask questions as we go along, we will do our best to answer them as we go. We might save them up for the end. We'll see what we feel really, but use the Q&A function down at the bottom because it just helps us manage them a little bit easier. Yeah, if you're not joining us live, you're listening on Spotify or Amazon Music, then thanks for finding us. You can catch all of our back episodes wherever you listen to your podcast, so check us out. What are we talking about today?
We're talking about managing sickness absence. We're specifically going to talk about managing what we would call long-term absence. So, I mean, it's been all over the press, the sort of the notes, comments from doctors signing people off. It's a massive, massive problem, and I'm sure it is for the organisations that you guys are working with, which is why you're joining us today. But we're not going to deal with what we would categorise as short-term absence. So that's like the odd day off here and there, above certain trigger points, for example, or that might have become a pattern of behaviour, because that's actually a different process. We're going to talk about longer term absence, and I use that term loosely because each organisation will have different ideas of what long term absence actually means. But we're talking about a sustained period of absence due to ill health. Now, from where we see it, sitting in our lovely ivory tower in our office advising clients on how to manage it, I think that when we're having a chat this morning, we're talking about it largely falling into three categories. So, the ones that we typically see are sickness absences that arise due to severe illness. So, cancer, long COVID is something that's come up, people that are off with operations, etc., and are recovering from operations. Then we see a second category of people that go off sick where they may have been invited to some kind of formal process, so a disciplinary meeting or a performance management process. And I probably don't need to make any particular comment in relation to that, because all of you will have had that to deal with, I'm sure. And then the third one is perhaps where you have somebody who's gone off sick arising out of poor relationships with colleagues, work-related stress, which will usually go hand in hand with some kind of formal grievance. And that's sort of a very crude way, really, of categorizing the types of absences that we're talking about. Now, in terms of process, the process is going to largely be the same, but there are nuances. There's always going to be nuances around how we would say you might want to deal with it. But I think the most important part is kind of your starting point. It's establishing where you set off, isn't it, Peter?
Yeah, absolutely, because different organizations have different approaches, and different organizations will have a different understanding of what they consider to be long-term absence versus short-term absence. Now, that could be when your company sick pay is exhausted, if indeed you even have company sick pay. It could be after 1 month, could be after 3 months. It might be specified in a sickness policy. It might not
Yeah.
be. But I think one of the, I suppose, the first key takeaway point from us is just simply don't let the situation drift,
Yeah.
because once you get to the point where someone's been off for so long and there hasn't been any management of it, it starts to look then like dismissal really is the only option. And actually, if you're involved at
Yeah.
an earlier stage,
Yeah.
dismissal might not actually be that only option, right?
No, absolutely. And I think even if, I mean, you mentioned long-term absence being guided by the amount of sick pay. I mean, I think my view is that it's really important to establish a line of communication right at the very start. So it doesn't have to be come to a formal meeting. It can just be literally checking in to see how you're doing, you know, if somebody's been off for a couple of weeks. Whether, you know, and this is what I'm talking about, nuances. In a situation where somebody isn't falling out with their manager, isn't facing a process, that can easily come from the manager. Just checking in, see how you're doing, see how you're feeling. If, however, obviously it's something that may well have arisen as a result of a fallout with the manager, or there is a formal process, then clearly they're not going to want to hear from a manager, but they should hear from somebody from HR, in my view, you know, just reaching out if you want to talk, you know, so you're establishing that line of communication. I would say that there is always, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't, because employees will turn around and say, you hounded me when I wasn't well. Or if you don't, it's you didn't reach out and see how I was. So, but look, I think at the
I take
moment,
a certain view on that,
yeah.
actually, which my general rule of thumb with that is, and if you're on the call today and we happen to have had discussions on long-term sickness issues, you might well have heard me say this. I usually take an approach of it's okay to keep contacting until such time as someone says, hey, don't,
Back off.
back
Yeah.
off, basically.
Yeah.
I think once you've had that that back off, if you're then still pushing the subject, that's where it can get problematic for you, and we'd recommend that you do back off. But until that time, I think you're entitled as an employer to take those steps to manage your employee, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And when we've been to the point where it's all gone horribly wrong and we're into lawyers' letters going backwards and forwards, very often we'll receive a letter from the employee's lawyer saying, you hounded her, your client did this. And our response will simply be, we are perfectly entitled to manage the absence of our employees. And that's what HR team did. And it's part of the duty of care. But anyway, let's assume that it hasn't gone all tits up, frankly, and we're at that point where we are just reaching out. That's the keeping the door open in terms of the communication, which I think is important. It's trying to build that relationship so that you can have it, because it is going to become difficult. So you might as well start and set that up from the start. But I think the second point as well, when we're looking at it from a start, is please go back and have a look at whatever your policy says, so that at least you know that you're going to be the process that you're going to then embark on is set out in the process and in your policy. Because if the employee is unhappy about it, they'll go through that with a fine-tooth comb and say, well, you didn't do that, you didn't do this. So, you know.
I mean, what your policy is probably going to do then is just set up this first formal meeting. And we'll come on in a little while, actually, and just talk about what we've seen around some of the practical difficulties in getting this meeting to happen in the first place, which we appreciate can be challenging sometimes. But assuming you can get to the stage where you get the employee along to a meeting, and by the way, that could be an in-person meeting, it might be something that you're doing virtually, like we're talking to you today. Some of the things that you're probably going to want to talk about in that first meeting are what a likely return date could be. That point we were just talking about future contact. You know, what are the arrangements for future contact? What's the frequency of contact going to be? What's the method of contact going to be? Are you going to be doing it through the individual? Are you going to be doing it through a family member, for example? Key point, and again, we'll come on and talk about this in a bit more detail shortly, but this question of disability. So, does the individual have a disability? Obviously, there's a massive correlation between long-term sickness and somebody being disabled. And when we employment lawyers talk about disability, we're talking about it in the sense of the Equality Act 2010. And I think it's fair to say it's a relatively lower threshold for establishing disability than maybe in other circumstances, but parking that point. Can the individual come back to work? You know, do they feel they're going to be in a position to return to work? Do they feel that they can come back if there are certain adjustments that can be made? And we'll talk about reasonable adjustments and what all that means in a second. Are there any alternatives? So is it possible to redeploy the individual? Can they have some additional training to be redeployed into another part of the business? Is there a return to work program that's available? And if so, what are the mechanics around that? So, you know, that's not an exhaustive list of things to be thinking about, but that's kind of a good starting point in terms of once you've got the employee in front of you, these are some of the questions you've got. Now, you're not necessarily going to get all of the answers to those in that one single meeting, but if you get into the mindset and get the employee thinking about these things as well, then you can start to work sometimes a little bit more collaboratively to an end resolution, whatever that might be. But it kind of starts with investigation of what's going on, really, doesn't it? I think, Jen.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I was listening to you talking about the types of things that you might discuss in that first meeting. And obviously, the first thing that we're going to want to know is what's the reason for the absence, because frankly, looking at some kind of physical disability is going to be easier for the employee to work out whether or not they think they're going to be able to do their job. Because, you know, if they're doing a job that does have physical limitations for them, then they're going to be much more open to talk about it. If it's a mental disability, a mental health, or something like that, then it's going to be a little bit more tricky, and it may not be that you can get that kind of information at that stage. So at the start, let's look at what the reason is. Let's look at what they're suffering from, and have a conversation with them about what the cause is, what's been the trigger, for example. And here I'm specifically looking at things like workplace stress, relationships with managers that might have impacted mental health. So it's having that conversation with the employee.
What
And I
about
think,
medical evidence?
yeah, you see, this
Example
is where I
that.
think it's critical. So a number of times I would typically get a phone call, which is, can I talk to you about somebody who's been off work now for 4 weeks? They've raised a grievance about their workload or their manager or their colleague or something, and we want to do something about it. And my first question will be, okay, so they've been off with 4 weeks. Have you sent them off to occupational health? And oh, no, we haven't yet. Now, occupational health for me is really, really critical in this situation. And let me first just sort of talk about how that might differ from any doctor's report you might get. I guess the clue's in the title. It's occupational health because you're sending them off to somebody who's got a medical expertise, particularly looking at their health condition and what can be done in the work context, whereas the doctor or anybody treating them might look at their condition in a sort of a therapeutic environment, shall we say. So occupational health is really, really important. What can you expect from occupational health? Well, for those of you who've already used it, you'll know that there's a referral form. There's sort of like some standard questions which are usually asked. And most of the time, those standard questions are fine on their own. In terms of getting the report back, this is what it's going to tell you. It's going to give you more detail on their condition. And yes, if anybody asks me, it will largely regurgitate what the employee has told them, which is fine because there may be useful information in there. Why they're off, what the triggers are, what things might be able to be done to encourage a return to work. So typically, for example, if the employee's raised a grievance, you might see in the occupational health report a sentence which says, if matters can be resolved at work, then the employee will feel better. Right. So that might then say to the employee, well, come on, engage with us. Let's go through this grievance process. Come meet with us when maybe they've been trying to avoid it, because that will help you feel better. That's what it says in the report. Okay. Then you'd be looking at things like advice on what the return to work might look like. So typical phased return. And this might suggest some adjustments for you to think about. But just a sort of a point on that, and Peter, I think you'll probably come on to it a bit later. The occupational health advisor can only suggest adjustments to you because they won't know whether those adjustments are going to be reasonable for your business, and that's up to you to decide. I suppose my only advice on that would be is that if, where at all possible, put the adjustments in place, but and have good business reasons where you couldn't, where they might not be reasonable. And the report will also give you some guidance whether in the medical practitioner's view that this person is disabled for the purposes of the Equality Act. But again, the caveat to that is ultimately that's a test that can really only be battened down at an employment tribunal by a judge, and we don't really want to end up in that position
Yeah,
because
the judge is a decision maker if there's a dispute.
absolutely.
I just want to jump in there again, just because whilst you're talking about occupational health reports, and we've had a few questions in, so thanks everyone who's been asking the questions, but two similar questions which are along the lines of what do we do if someone's refusing to go and see occupational health? And one of the people asking the questions mentions that in their employment contract, I think it makes reference to the individual being obliged to go in to see occupational health on request.
Yeah. I love this. I love this question. And it comes up so often. And I've also advised individuals in this situation. So if the employee is refusing to engage with occupational health, yes, first of all, you can point out that's in their contract. But much more powerful is to say to the employee, look, you know, we're trying to make a decision on how we handle your absence and frankly, your continued employment. And we can only do that with the benefit of occupational health guidance. And it's in your interest to do so, because otherwise we're going to make a decision based on what we know. And what we know at the moment is you're off sick. So we don't have enough information. So please do reconsider your request. And then all of a sudden the employee thinks, maybe it's a good idea. Now, that's the kind of fierce way of doing it. The other way of doing it, and this probably relates to one of the other questions that I can see about how engaged the employee is with you, is if you have opened that good line of communication with the employee and they're nervous about going to occupational health, explain to them what's going to happen. Say to them, this is your opportunity to tell the occupational health advisor how you feel, what might be good for you, you know, what, how you think you might return to work, what role you think you can do. This is your opportunity and we really urge you to go to it. Now, obviously, that's if the employee engages. If they then don't bother, then you just go, okay, well, you said you won't go. We can only base our decision on what we know. Come to a meeting, please. There's another
kind of technical point around that as well, isn't there? Without going down the rabbit hole of GDPR and access to medical records and sensitive personal data, which medical and health information is, you can pack someone off to occupational health, but they can withhold their consent to share the report with you or with, you know, with anybody. So then the value of it is completely lost because you're not going to actually see what the occupational health recommendations are. I think that puts you back into the situation where you've tried your best to ascertain what the medical information is, what the medical position is. And so I think to some degree you can be forgiven for saying, well, we've tried to do our best, the employee's not playing ball. But just bear in mind that, and this was one of the things that I think was significant when GDPR came in and how employment contracts had been drafted. Don't rely on something in your employment contract saying you've got to go and see occupational health if we ask you to, as being synonymous with you having an absolute right to see the occupational health report, because they're two different things. So it's just a lookout. Just one other quick question somebody asked as well, I've got to remind myself. Can we ask occupational health contact employees, doctor, to verify or clarify the condition? Yeah, I mean, that's a really good idea. And it's something that we do flag. But of course, it's incumbent on the individual employee giving consent for the occupational health practitioner or a company to go and approach their general practitioner or specialist. Sometimes people are under specialist care, of course. And if the individual doesn't provide that consent, then the OH is not going to be able to see that information. But it is good to be thinking along those lines.
Just be prepared for that to slow things down massively.
Yeah,
because getting hold of getting responses from doctors isn't that quick.
Can take time.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing around this, managing this process. It does require a lot of patience. Can I just answer a couple of other questions while we're on this topic? Yeah. So one of the questions is, what do you do if the employee is not responding to your calls and emails, so you cannot establish the line of communication from the start? Yes, that happens an awful lot. It's a question, again, of just trying to do your best. So, you know, it may be that if someone's not answering you, you can say to them, look, if you've got a problem, if you've got a problem with it, me being the point of contact, let me know if someone else can reach out to you. It's really important. But again, if an employee is just pushing back and back, then you're going to have to embark on the more formal stages of that process at an earlier stage. So you would say, we want to now formally invite you to a meeting. You give them the right to be accompanied. You might even go that extra step and say, we won't just limit it to a work colleague or a trade union rep. If you want to bring a member of your family to support you, provided they're not an employment lawyer, then that's absolutely fine. It's just about trying to do your best and then following up on that if you don't hear anything, until ultimately you're going to get to that point where if the employee refuses to engage, you're going to say, we've got no choice but now to invite you to a final meeting. And if you don't turn up, a decision on what we do with you will be made in your absence. And you know, it's a question of working through those steps. And I have seen it happen, but normally what happens is the employee panics towards the end and then says, okay, we'll come and meet with you, and then you're back in train.
Okay, so you get the OH report.
Yeah.
What do you
Then
then
what?
do with it?
Yeah. Then I think that there's a step that's often missed is you must then just say to the employee, hey, you've seen the report, we've seen the report, let's have a meeting to talk through it. Because the employee may say, yeah, no, I agree with everything in the report, but here's another adjustment that would be really useful to me. Or no, that adjustment they've suggested won't be useful to me, but this might. And it's really important to get the employee, again, working collaboratively to go through that report so that you end up with a plan in place. Now, that's obviously where adjustments can be required. What about the case when the OH report says we can't foresee a return to work in the next few months or something like that? You'd still go discuss it with the employee, wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, in that situation, and again, the advice I tend to give to clients is that's the type of phraseology we're looking for in an OH report if we want to get to that point of unfortunately terminating employment. Because if there's no imminent return to work, an employer can't be expected to wait forever. But it's then really super important that you do sit down with the employee and said, look, this report says you're not going to be able to come back. Is that what you think? You know, in which case, well, where do we go from here? We can't hold your job open. And it's leading into that conversation. So discussion with the employee is critical.
So I just want to pick up on that then and talk about reasonable adjustments actually. But before I do, just in terms of arrangements for these types of meetings, so you know, the first meeting we mentioned where you're thinking about all those different considerations about contact and whether to go to OH, and then any sort of meeting where you're talking about the OH report or any other medical evidence that you've obtained. Just bear in mind that it might, of course, be very difficult for the individual to come into a place of work to actually hold that meeting. So there's absolutely no restriction on you holding a meeting virtually, if that suits everybody, doing something by telephone, or even just meeting at a neutral venue, which I've had clients do before, where people are kind of a bit more comfortable rather than facing this fear maybe of coming into a workplace.
But
Obviously,
not a Costa coffee shop where you can be overheard.
not Costa Coffee. Yeah, no offense to Costa Coffee.
Or any other well-known coffee shop.
Obviously, if an individual is classed as being disabled within the meaning of the Equality Act, then you're going to be under a duty to look at making reasonable adjustments. And it's something that we get asked an awful lot, isn't it, Adrian, around, well, what's a reasonable adjustment?
Yeah.
What sort of things do we need to consider? A really, really good resource, actually, that you might want to check out if you're interested in this is the Equality and Human Rights Commission. They've got, can't remember if it's called a code or a statutory guide. I forget the exact terminology of the
I think it's a
information,
code.
the code of practice.
Yeah.
They've got a really, really useful resource. It's available for free online. You can download it as a PDF or a Word document. And within that document, they've got loads and loads of practical examples around what constitutes a reasonable adjustment. Now, you've got to bear in mind that there's no exhaustive list of reasonable adjustments, though, and also what's reasonable, even within your own organization, what's reasonable on one occasion for one individual might not be reasonable for another individual faced with a different set of circumstances. So it can change. So bear in mind reasonable adjustments in terms of the arrangements for actually holding these meetings. But what about reasonable adjustments in terms of actually a means of assisting somebody back into the workplace? Well, our recommendation is always that you go through that process in consultation with the individual. So what you're looking for is, can you adjust anything? And it can be a physical adjustment. And that super easy example is, you know, always used to be, you know, building an access ramp to the front of your office so somebody can access the office space if they're otherwise prevented from doing so because of a disability. To an organizational adjustment. So that could be changing somebody's role, changing their job description, changing the duties that are required of them, changing their working hours, changing their reporting line, changing their start finish times. You know, all those sorts of things are possible as well. But do it in consultation or try and do it in consultation with the individual because you can ask the individual employee for their ideas about what can be adjusted. And there's some value in doing that, right? But it isn't enough for you just to rely on that. So what you can't do is say, Well, we asked the individual and they didn't have any ideas, so we didn't do anything about reasonable adjustments. The obligation is on you as the employer, not on the individual. So they're, you know, you're engaging with them to canvass their opinion, get their suggestions, because they're the one doing the job. But ultimately, the responsibility still lies with you.
Yeah.
Other things to think about, are there any other jobs within the business that might be more suitable for them? And again, you can also take medical advice, if necessary, on the reasonable adjustments themselves as well. So that's another step that you could go to, and it might be appropriate to go to in certain situations. Don't forget reasonable adjustments, the duty to make it also applies to the processes that you're following as well. Now, an easy example of that could be your policy in terms of capability processes might say somebody's only got a right to be accompanied by a trade union official or a colleague, you know, another employee. And for somebody with a disability, what you might want to do is flex that and make an adjustment and say, okay, to help you with an understanding of the process or help you communicate with us effectively, get your points across, we're going to permit you to be accompanied by a family member. So be open to reasonable adjustments to the actual process that you're following as well. Because if you're not, then that's an area where you could be attacked legally.
Can I just jump in on there? So because a question's been asked, and I think it's a really, really good one, and it's relevant to what we're talking about. So the question that's been asked is, how do you approach an illness when the doctor's recommendations are to work from home, but the employee is required to be in the office a number of times a week? So this, I think, ties in absolutely with whether or not an adjustment that's been suggested is reasonable. So you've got a doctor, it may be an occupational health recommendation, it doesn't really matter, because ultimately suggestions will be made by the medics, and it's up to you to decide what's reasonable. Now, in a situation where the recommendation is to work from home, but the requirement is to be in the office, the question for you is, why is there a requirement to be in the office? Why is it that you don't think it's reasonable for them to work from home, and how are we going to justify it? Now, that can be for a variety of reasons. It could be simply that the role cannot be done from home. It's a hands-on role, needs to be in the office, etc., all the rest of it. Or it could be that the company, and many companies do have this, we see it all over the news now where there's a real reversal from working from home, is that there is going to be an ethos of everybody needs to be office-based for at least some of the time. So, you know, say, for example, somebody's off sick, maybe they've not been with you very long, maybe they've got performance issues, and in which case they would massively benefit to improve their performance or to get to know the business by being in the office alongside colleagues, because that's the way it is. Now, that might be a perfectly reasonable adjustment. Perfectly reasonable reason for you to say, well, that's not a reasonable adjustment in terms of your role. But it's making sure that if you're going to take this stance and go against the medical adjustments, you must be able to say, we are saying no to that adjustment because, and here's the business reason. And I think that's a really critical point. But, you know, you don't have to be a slave to what the suggestions have been if it doesn't work for you as a business. But, you know, but also there's going to be some mid ground. So it might be, we think you're best off being in the office and that's what we need because of X, Y, and Z, but we can be flexible. Why don't you do it for a couple of weeks? And then we'll be looking to transition you back into the office more longer term.
What about, so you've gone through that process then, you've looked at reasonable adjustments, you've got the occupational health report.
Yeah.
You're at the phase where you might be contemplating dismissal.
Dun, dun, dun.
I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that's the point where you have to sit back and first of all, do a review of the process that's been followed. Have you had a fair process? Have you got the evidence that you needed? Have you been talking to the employee? You know, have you had the welfare meetings? Go back and check your policy. Have you ticked all the boxes in terms of that? And if you have, and you've got to the point where, you know, the employee is not likely to return to work, then that's the point when you would write to them and say, here's a summary of where we are so far. This is what we've done to date. This is the guidance that we've had. You know, we are going to have to talk about the next steps, which unfortunately might include ending your employment, come to a meeting, write to be accompanied, etc., etc., and then you would be holding that meeting with the employee. So it's giving them that advance notice, making sure that they're very clear that their employment could be terminated at that meeting.
Yeah. Now, a very common question that we get is, what if the employee fails to attend that meeting or refusing to attend that meeting? And that's really quite a knotty one because, you know, the employee might want to be delaying the inevitable, or they may be genuinely unwell and not actually able to attend that meeting. Sometimes you get into a dispute over whether an employee is actually fit enough to attend a meeting. Now, bizarre as that sounds, there's a difference between being unwell such that you can't fulfill the requirements of your job and being unwell such that you're not able to attend a meeting with your employer to discuss your health situation or a disciplinary matter or a grievance matter. They're different things. So we have done this in the past. I've seen this happen, and it is something to consider. You can obtain medical evidence just to answer a discrete question about whether somebody is well enough to simply engage in a capability process or a disciplinary process. So you're not asking for a kind of full bells and whistles report to answer that point. It's just, does this person have an understanding of what's going on? Are they capable of attending? Are there any adjustments we can make to the process to get them along? So that is something that you can deploy. If non-attendance is due to illness or disability, then the recommendation is normally that you adjourn a meeting rather than you proceed in the employee's absence, unless you get information that further attempts to meet within a reasonable time scale are just going to be frustrated. Okay. Yeah. So what do you do in that situation? Well, obviously, as employment lawyers, we like to come at it from the angle of, well, if this ends up in some kind of claim, disability discrimination claim, unfair dismissal claim, how is a judge going to be looking at this? What's a tribunal's view going to be? And they're going to look a lot more favourably on you if they can see that you've made every effort to try and be accommodating and to try to be reasonable. However, a tribunal will also recognise that there comes a point where you as an
enough is enough.
And you have to be able to make a decision at some point, and you've got the best available evidence open to you. So you can certainly get to a point where you can proceed without this face-to-face meeting with the employee. Now, all I'd say on that is if you are going to proceed in the employee's absence, you've made it super clear to the employee that that's the route that you're going to go down. You've given them plenty of opportunity to attend a meeting, and you invite written submissions or written representations from the employee or someone on their behalf to kind of make their case and make it clear that you've taken all of that into consideration. Obviously, do take it into consideration, but when you make your decision, make clear that you have taken account of everything that the employee has told you, so you can make a fair decision and get to a fair outcome. I know we're going to mention something briefly on PHI, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a really good catch, that one. So a couple of things just to remember here is while you're merrily on your route down to potentially terminating an employee, there's two things to watch out for. First of all, have you got any form of permanent health insurance benefit in place, or might be called long-term disability benefit? If you have and you don't allow the employee the opportunity to move on to that benefit, that is potentially a very expensive claim. So typically these kick in, say, after 6 months, and they provide a percentage of pay to the employee. If the employee does have that benefit, then you would make the referral and let the insurer's medics make a decision as to whether or not they would qualify under it. But the point being is that if you dismiss the employee before they potentially get the chance to even apply for that benefit, yeah, there is a potential for any claim to include the losses that the earnings that they would have got through that insurance policy until such time as they might return to work, the expiry of the policy, which can on occasions be retirement age. So you can see how that could be very costly. The second thing to check as well is that there's, if we're talking sort of serious illness, speak to your pension scheme in case there's any scope for early retirement on ill health grounds, because again, that's something else that is an option that you could explore.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're two really good watch outs. I'm mindful of time, and I want to just try and get some of the questions that we've been asked as well. So we'll wrap up in a few minutes, but just a quick word on something else we get asked about as well, which is frustration of contract. And I can certainly recall being asked about whether that's an option for employers. So a quick word on frustration. Frustration is a common law concept where basically the employment contract is treated as being discharged without fault of either party. And I think the times that I have seen it kind of validly kick in are where somebody's been imprisoned for a long period of time, and obviously they're not going to be able to get out of prison to turn up and do whatever their day job is. So it's kind of neither party's fault, although I suppose you could argue that being a criminal is not conducive to good employment relations. But you can see how it's analogous to somebody being on long-term sick, and well, is there an argument the contract's been frustrated because somebody's too unwell to come and do it? What happens there is the contract's discharged by operation of law, and it doesn't count as a dismissal under the Employment Rights Act. Therefore, you're not facing any type of unfair dismissal risk because there hasn't actually been a dismissal in law. And as I say, it's normally deemed to have occurred independently of either party, so without fault. It's strictly speaking not an option for employers to elect because it just happens independently of either party's intentions. And the case is, a lot of the authorities that we've got on it are from a long time ago, i.e. 1970s, which, as an 80s child, I'm going to say that was quite a long time ago. Tribunals are super reluctant to look at frustration, I think, because what's happened since those cases were decided is that there's been a lot of developments on unfair dismissal case law and obviously disability discrimination that we've now got within the Equality Act and Disability Discrimination Act before that. So the doctrine of frustration is far less attractive for tribunals to look at because they don't want to be seen to be giving employers a bit of an escape route, I guess, like an easy way out, if I can characterize it that way. So, although it might occur on super, super rare occasions, I don't normally see it as the as something that really happens. It's usually not really a viable option.
I think
Am I
the
going to
one
say
thing that I would just
something?
add to that, no, I was just going to just add to that is that in reality, you're talking about somebody who's been off for so long without any sort of like management touch points that that it realistically it's almost like they've been forgotten about, the contract's been forgotten about, and that. But certainly in any normal situation, I think it's really unlikely. But the whole point of this is that we're encouraging you to jump on these things a bit quicker and manage them so that they don't drag on.
It makes me think we always then seem to get these crazy European decisions, and I don't know why. It's always somebody in Spain that's been employed by a water company and they've been off sick for 15 years on full pay, and no one's realized. It tends to be those in the report from time to time, but anyway, I know we've got a few questions. In terms of the, let me just, or let's just run through a couple of those that we can. Do we have good referrals for occupational health? Possibly, and I'll drop you a line, Elizabeth, actually separately. I think if I wasn't employment lawyer, I'd be setting up an occupational health referral
Yeah, me too.
because I'm sure it'd be an absolute goldmine. Because I've had hit and miss experiences with OH and had a really good provider, and I think they retired or something changed. And
They got taken over.
oh, okay. And
Yeah, they got taken over by a not so good provider.
so I'll drop you a line, Elizabeth. Should you get an occupational health report and a report from the GP before moving to capability and possible? I mean, there's no, as far as I'm concerned, you don't have to get a report from the GP. I mean, you don't have to get a report from either, right? It's all about
It's about putting
making
yourselves
the
in the best
most,
possible position.
exactly, put yourself in that best possible position, getting the most information that you can. But I don't think it's necessary to absolutely get an occ health report and a GP report. Normally, an
Well,
occ
I
report would be
wouldn't.
the go-to.
Yeah, I mean, I normally would just go for the occupational health because I've had situations where a GP report is directly in contradiction to the OH report and is therefore unhelpful. But I think Peter made the point that if OH recommends a specialist input from the doctors treating the employee, that might be a situation where you would. So it's a question of looking at it and deciding what's going to put you in the best possible position to make a decision on which you can then defend if you end up in an employment tribunal. So.
Elaine said access to work can be really helpful in suggesting reasonable adjustments. And yeah, I know I've worked with them before. Actually, that's a really good shout. So check out access to work if you need some external support. I think it might be free.
Yes.
And we've had a couple of quite long questions, actually. Let me try
Well,
and sort them.
I'll take the first one. The first one's, do we have to have absence review meetings if we've got up-to-date occupational health reports, which says unlikely to return, and you've had regular well-being meetings throughout the period of absence? Well, I think it depends what your terminology is in terms of an absence review meeting, but certainly where you've got somebody who's off on long-term sick, unlikely to return, or you know exactly what's going on because you've got all the reports. The you wouldn't be giving them warnings about not coming back by a certain time, but your absence review would be the check-in, the well-being meetings you're talking to. So if you've got all that in place and you've got to the point where they're not likely to return, the next logical bit is to set up your final meeting with them to talk about bringing their employment to an end. So if from that person's from your question on there, I would be saying, right, well-being meetings tick, medical evidence tick. Do we have full knowledge of the reason for absence? Yes. What's their likely return date? We don't know. There isn't one. Okay, let's proceed.
That's sound advice, or suggestions. I should say we're not giving legal advice on these
Yes.
webinars, so keep my insurer happy. There's two final questions, which I think they're must be from the same person. They're kind of related. Let me just try and summarize them. So the scenario is that a job requires the employee to be present on site at all times. We've conducted several OH assessments and made reasonable adjustments over 3 years. Despite this, sickness has not improved and could be classified as disability. Employee continues to call in sick frequently, making it difficult for the company to manage its ops. The company's provided sick pay. At this stage, what options do we have to deal with it? And how long do you need to get to that final meeting when the employee's been on and off work due to sickness for months and it's an ongoing pattern?
Different. This is different from what we've been talking about
Yeah, it
today,
is
because this is
different.
the bit about the persistent absence. But I would just say, in that situation, if it could be classified as a disability, presumably your Oc Health assessments will be telling you whether it is. So you've put in place adjustments. You know, if their sickness absence is still not acceptable to you, you'd be meeting with the employee saying, "We put in place all these adjustments. It's still not making any difference. What else can we do to improve your attendance?" And if the employee says nothing, then you're in the position of potentially deciding whether or not to give them a formal warning, and then going up your ladder of warnings with setting out parameters of what your expectations are for their attendance. But having that conversation, that's the point where we come back to at the start of all of this, which is you are engaging with the employee and you're talking about the reason for the absence, and also engaging with them about whether the adjustments that you've put in place are reasonable.
Yeah,
So
absolutely.
it's that situation. But yeah, in that one, you're into a formal ladder of warnings, in my view. But then obviously, it depends very much on what the whole story is. But if you'd like proper advice on based on everything that you've got, then do get in touch with us, because we'd be pleased to help.
Yeah, it sounds like a situation where you need some advice applicable to the specific context that you've got. Thanks for all your questions, everybody. That's great. Let me just summarize with our tips to say seven takeaway points really. So the first is decide what your organization thinks is long-term sickness absence, just so you've got a consistent approach with people. Number two, don't let things drift. That's really important. Number three, stay in touch as far as possible with the employee. Number four, get the medical evidence that you need, or make an attempt to get the medical evidence that you think you need to see. Number five, include the employee in the decision-making process. So speak to them, try and have this dialogue. Number six, run a fair capability process with the individual if you're at the capability stage. Number seven, don't get bogged down in what constitutes a disability. So, we tend to advocate taking a pragmatic approach and still consider any adjustments that can be made anyway. You know, even if you're not under a legal duty to make the adjustments, it might be a means of avoiding having to dismiss somebody, keeping them engaged, keeping them within the workforce, if it's acceptable to you, of course. So there are seven tips from today. Thanks so much for joining us. As I mentioned at the start of the call, you can get all of our back episodes on Spotify and Amazon Music. You just need to look for Employment Law 101. We are back live in 2 weeks' time. So same time, Thursday at 11 a.m., 2 weeks' time, we're going to be looking at top tips for managing underperformance. So another hot topic. Join us then to ask your questions. In the meantime, have a good weekend when it arrives. Take care, everybody.